All right. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. It's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday. That means Friday's with Sandy Williams. And Sandy, we're gonna continue the conversation that we had right before the break, because I think it is absolutely essential that we start warning people of what could be coming. You know, we talk about the wars and all of those different things, the military and all of those different things, but this Silicon Valley Bank and what has transpired, there are analysts, you know, Moody's and other places who seem to think that it is going to affect the housing market. And if the housing market crashes, there's a domino effect, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the economy is all interconnected. And, you know, we had a real estate-based, you know, the inflation in the 70s started with oil, but ultimately it was high interest rates and the real estate industry that fell on its face that created a deep recession at that point. I think you were talking about remembering those days,
right,
when in the layoffs in your career. And now we're beginning to see a bunch of leading indicators. Okay, I just heard today about something I hadn't heard talked about before. The accounting industry measures something that they call the M factor, which is the extent to which companies are using aggressive accounting techniques to cause their income statement to bring income closer in time, to increase the income they can report this quarter and next quarter. And the use of that aggressiveness usually comes at a time when they're stretching to realize income because there's a slowdown in their business and they don't want to show a loss of profit in the near term, and so they're fighting to show profit. And it turns out that when the accounting industry measured the M factor recently, it's at almost an all-time high, meaning that businesses are beginning to use very aggressive approaches to try and show more profits in the near term, which could cost them the ability to show profits in the long term, which shows this kind of desperate quality. That tells me that we might be headed towards, you know, that the business numbers haven't yet reflected what is on the horizon for a slowdown. And the problem we have in America and in our business methodology, and particularly without the safety net that Europe has for its workers, is that it's the Tom, Dick, and Mary, the people that don't have intergenerational wealth, who really suffer in the circumstance of a recession. And if we have material layoffs, we had material layoffs during the pandemic, but because of the fact that there was this health effect, government had the rationale they could use to step in and do all kinds of things to keep us from actually suffering the results of the recession. We had rent relief, we had rent supplements, we had rent forgiveness, we had supplemental pay,
yes,
we had the PPP plan, we had all kinds of things to insulate us from the actual. And many people during that recession were actually experiencing income.
Living better than they were before. Right.
That isn't going to happen the next recession we have, because it's not going to be, we won't be able to point at a factor like COVID-19 as its cause. It's just going to be a business cycle outcome. So I am worried about a recession on the horizon. I do think people ought to be aware of the fact that it might be happening. I'd be interested in what our listeners think, because really, recessions are all about psychological outlook. Are people feeling pessimistic? Does that make them less likely to consume? When they pull in their horns and don't consume because they're worried about the future, that accelerates the time in which we realize the recession. So, you know, my telling people, pull in your horns, be careful, is almost like a self-fulfilling potential prophecy, because if everyone does it, we'll have a recession.
So, Sandy, many of our listeners are kind of insulated from the recession because we're retired. And the recessions are going to impact and hurt the people who work every day still, the younger,
yes,
population of people who don't have a pension and Social Security and those things that are immune from recession.
Yeah, the only thing for the retired, the thing that won't be immune is your 401k program, if that's what you're relying on. If we have a recession and the stock market, I mean, people can talk about the stock market going down in the last while, but it's at 32,000.
And anyone, it's still way up.
Anyone who's been investing in the stock market over the years is still fat on their stock market investments. But if we had a deep recession, we could expect, you know, that to go down too. And we all remember what happened in 2008. 2008 was a very deep recession. I don't foresee something like that. But, you know, you never know. Recessions, like I've said before, they don't happen slowly. They happen suddenly, and they always come with a cause. And the cause is always the truck you didn't see when you step off the curb. You don't ever get hit by the truck you see.
You know, Sandy, it is so I sometimes wonder if we've been putting off the recessions, this recession, for a long time. And so we knew the continued growth is not going to last forever. There's no way the uptick is going to last forever. And this one has lasted almost as long as almost anyone in history. So at some point in time, we knew this was inevitable. There was going to be one. Has staving it off made it more severe, possibly more severe?
Well, I think staving it off, and also just some things that we've done geopolitically, a big part of this long-term growth has been the impetus from globalization. And it's, you know, the growth in sales for most corporations, most large corporations, did not occur in the United States. Their growth in sales and profits occurred outside the United States into growing marketplaces. The United States market itself does not grow at a rapid basis, anywhere near as rapidly as the growth in markets like China, for instance. And so to the extent that we get sequestered away from, separated away from, deglobalized, and the more we rely on the U.S. economy for our sales as well as our production, the less potential growth we experience. We have a very mature economy. Mature economies do not grow as rapidly as the immature economies that are growing into their pants, you know?
You know, Sandy, it's it continues to be something that we have to keep our eye on, right? Because this is not going away quickly.
Well, and if I were Wall Street, and if I were the business community, I would be focused on installing some safety net situational things that would deal with it, so that, for instance, healthcare would get taken care of, and child daycare would get taken care of, and education would get taken care of, so that you realize then that the level of desperation that would be experienced by those who would be laid off might be mitigated.
So none of those things are going to happen before whatever is coming now that's on its way. These will be things that they long-term.
Well, I guess. I mean, we do have some... I don't know how rapidly a recession is coming. I have the sense that it's getting closer. I also have the sense that politically, the more we talk about international affairs and feeding a war machine, the more less likely it is that we will spend money on domestic problems. And it's the domestic problems that we need to deal with, particularly in light of a recession. And my hope is that there aren't those in Washington who believe that a good war will solve every recession, you know, that all we need is a good military conflict to prop up the economy, because, you know, we're worried about deficits. And ever since Vietnam, we've been willing to finance our military adventures on deficits, but we can't keep doing that. And in deficits expended on military adventures are not investments in our future. You know, if we want to have a deficit expenditure that's an investment on our future, it ought to be in the education of our people. It ought to be in the health care of our people. Those are investments that portend better productivity in the future in our economy, and better inclusiveness and more successful economy. Wartime expenditures do not create the same potential. And so the idea that we've, for 50 years now, invested our deficit in military expenditures is something that I think economists, principled people in our country, ought to stand up and argue about, and we ought not to be doing it.
You know, Sandy, the only way that those people will, apparently, just based on what I've been seeing over the years, Sandy, is have a come-to-Jesus moment, if you will, is if the American people pressure them to do that.
Well, you know, I mean, the American people have drunk the Kool-Aid and believe that that military activities abroad are being done to save American democracy, to save democracy across the world, which somehow seems to be our obligation, and that it's an obligation that that we have inherited in some fashion from I don't know whom. But the fact is that our military expenditures have not saved democracy any place we've done it, and we have basically avoided spending our military money in places where democracy has also been at risk. So we aren't doing this effectively, and I would argue that that isn't even why we're doing most of our military activities.
You know, Sandy, when we come back, I want us to talk. I want to talk a little bit about the state Supreme Court race and why there continues to be just the amount of money that the most expensive state Supreme Court race in history is happening in the state of Wisconsin. And I'd like to ask you why. Why in the state of Wisconsin? And because, you know, we're one state.
Yeah.
And a Supreme Court seat in one state, why it's a national issue. And so hold the thought. We are going to break. Our phone lines open at 844-967-2789. What are your thoughts? It's Friday. Friday's with my co-host, Sandy Williams. We'll be right back. You said you suspect what?
Every breath I take and each and every step I make brings me closer, baby, closer to you.
And with each beat of my heart, for every day we apart, I'll hunger for every wasted hour.
And every night and every day, I'm gonna get you, I'm gonna get you, look I called, I'm gonna get you.
Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday. Friday's with Sandy Williams. So, Sandy, the Supreme Court candidate seat of the state of Wisconsin is the most expensive seat in terms of the amount of money that's been spent in the history of Supreme Court races in the nation, and there's still several weeks to go. And I was asking you before we went to break, why?
Well, I mean, that's the thing. You have to ask yourself why, and the answers, I think, kind of smack you in the face. First of all, for national money to come in, it has to matter on some national issues, right?
Right.
And courts became a strategy of conservatives quite a long time ago. The Federalist Society came forward demonstrating that, look, federal court appointments are for life. So if you get someone in as a conservative for life, conservatives can have a far longer and wider influence by controlling the courts than they can by trying to control legislatures across the country, because legislatures ebb and flow, number one. Number two, the conservative movement might be something that has a half-life based on the boomer generation that is the basis for it. And so courts became a focus. State courts, why state courts? Well, look at the issues that matter. One of the issues is districting, the political districting, the question of gerrymandering, the question of approval of the redistricting of congressional seats. because the number of congressmen from the state of Wisconsin matters nationally, and if particularly if you do this nationwide, if you can affect one or two seats in each state, that's 100 seats you can affect across the country. So one seat, that's 50 seats. That's plenty to have a huge impact. Then the second issue that matters, obviously, for or has mattered for some while, is abortion. And abortion is something that is determined in our courts, you know. And so, you know, abortion is a concept that will be adjudicated in the state Supreme Court as well as districting. And so these, I think what's happened is the Republicans, or the conservatives, were operating under the radar for a while, pushing their candidates and getting conservative candidates successfully into the federal courts, particularly during the Trump period, but before that. And then at the state court level, they've been successful for 15 years in having disproportionately conservative courts as compared to the political, the profile of the state in which they were locating, particularly in Wisconsin, where we had essentially almost all of our justices were on the conservative side of the scales just several years ago. And so the Democrats, the liberals, I say it partisan.
Right.
It's a nonpartisan office, so I think you have to look at it ideologically. The liberals began to—
Yeah, you can look at it ideologically, but—
It is political.
It is, right.
It's become political. And so the liberals began to expend a great deal of money to offset the conservatives, and I would say that currently, in Wisconsin at least, it appears that the liberals are more excited about the race than the conservatives are. And I think it's because there's a fair amount of ambivalence that has grown over the abortion issue amongst people who would otherwise view themselves as conservative, particularly conservative women who, where when the Roe case was thrown out, I think the rubber hit the road for many women and they realized that the intrusiveness of what would follow, particularly in Wisconsin, where there is now an absolute ban on abortions, essentially, based on an 1849 statute that came into play, has created a much more ambivalent environment.
You know, the other side of it again, Sandy, is the Democrats have realized, state as far as the state is concerned, the damage that has occurred to Democratic beliefs, you know, right to work and all these other things that have come into vogue under the 15-year leadership of the Republican and control over the Supreme Court. And Democrats have sat by and watched this and basically been powerless.
Yeah, I mean, the Republican Party, it was even, the fact is it wasn't secret, it was public. A strategy is the state house. And beginning with
right.
Newt Gingrich, they said, we're going to focus on state houses. We have much more likelihood of having success there. It had a great deal to do with districting them and the districting of the maps. You had to control the courts ultimately to be sure that the redistricting you could get through your legislature would stand. And so this is all part of a program that was outlined and successfully carried out, and now we're seeing the expensive result of it because the yin of the conservative movement has run into the yang of the liberal, and particularly with respect to this court race, and it looks like it's going to be $30+ million. I mean, I think it was $20 million a couple of weeks
ago.
Yeah,
right, right.
And you can see that there's many money being spent every day, like it's going out of style.
You know, and I'll just tell you, you just explained it to me the best I've heard it, where, you know, I can see now why. But many others, just like me, are wondering why Wisconsin, why now? I've read where it said that this is the most important race in the entire nation in 2023. And that's saying a lot. But at the root of it, again, is abortion.
Well, and also pollsters have begun to look at it to see whether we're blue, red, or purple in terms of the general ideological outlook and how the votes fall in various places because it has become such a big contest with so much money spent. It is in many respects potentially a bellwether, a port tenor.
So that's why they've said that this could have some bearing on the presidency of the United States in 2024. I couldn't see how that could possibly be, but if you tie all those things together, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a forecaster. You look at it and you say, okay, Wisconsin's when Wisconsin is pressed with a lot of money and a big turnout in votes, it looks purple or it looks red or it looks blue.
All right, got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. Show as always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday. That means Fridays with my co-host Sandy Williams. Sandy, you are a big proponent of freedom of speech. I've heard you say it. If I heard you say it once, I've heard you say it many times. You really are a person who thinks that that is critically important in this democracy.
First Amendment, our founders thought it was the first thing that when they were making their Bill of Rights, that was the first thing they put down. So, yeah, I think it's fundamental.
So here we are. Kids in Utah will need parents' okay to access social media. Our phone lines are open at 844-967-2789, 844-967-2789. Love to hear your opinions, Sandy and I both, on this new bill that, according to the governor of Utah, children will not be able to access social media between 10:30 p.m. and 6:30 a.m., and it also need to have an okay from their parents. Yes, Sandy, your thoughts.
So they need parental approval to access the social media,
right,
and then they have a time limit. Well, China's imposed the same kind of time limit on TikTok. So I've said before, I thought that our politics and China's politics, top politics, were going to converge about the internet, because the internet is a troublesome thing, right? There's some terrible things to be found on the internet. It provides access to some of humanity's worst instincts in terms of the availability of child pornography, pornography generally, snuff movies. I mean, these horrible things that were apparently accessible. And however,
they were once not acceptable in this country.
Well, of course not. I mean,
right.
Well, they aren't acceptable now. They're not acceptable. But then, of course, there were things that weren't acceptable to be written in books. Lady Chatterley's Lover was banned, and Peyton Place was banned, and books that had any sort of risque, direct discussion of sex or sexual matters. And so it's a slippery slope to control speech. And the problem is that this internet speech issue is different, because it's like kind of a private phone booth into which kids can go, and then they can secretly look at all kinds of things. And so it is troublesome. I think parents definitely ought to exercise control over what their kids see and do on the internet, because I think the internet has within it some fundamental problems about what children can be exposed to. The question is, what should our government be doing with respect to it? I think our government should be actively providing education to parents about what they can do, what they should do. I think that probably internet providers ought to be required to have means for control that can be exercised by parents, so that it's not impossible to exercise control by a parent. Right now, I'm sure it's difficult even with the access to controls, because a kid could have a phone and lie about their age, and you know, they could pretend they're me, right? When I signed in, all I had to do was tell them what age I was,
right,
and it worked. So there's a lot of means issues, means questions. How does this get deployed? How does it get enforced that become a problem with government enforcement? And then, of course, if the government's going to start talking about content, I mean, one thing is time of access. That's different than controlling content. And I have less trouble with a time of access issue. But then again, I don't know. You know, my sense is that much of this should be controlled socially, but it should be controlled within families. It's a little bit like families trying to exercise control over what their children learn in school by trying to require school to only teach the things that the parents want to have taught. And we're already there with education,
right.
And it's become a big problem.
You know, Sandy, it's more than a notion to try to control what your child is going to be able to see and not see with the internet. I mean, how is it possible that any parent can police that?
Well, there are means for putting constraints on
right.
And I believe that
for little kids.
Well, no, I don't know the extent to which older. I don't understand the mechanism.
Right.
But
neither do I.
But I think there maybe ought to be a way. And most kids have phones that are on their parents' accounts. And that probably would give the ability of the parent to control what happens on the phone that's on their account. I think what happens if kids have phones that are on their own accounts, that'll be a different story. But, you know, I think we should focus more on the means for giving the means to parents to control what it is that their children do with respect to the internet more than it should be the government's process to control the internet, because that is a slippery slope.
But the conversation is even broader, Sandy, than the internet. I mean, it's books now. They're banning books. When you talk about freedom of speech and all of those different things, it's never been as infringed upon that I can recall in my lifetime as it is right now.
Well, in the 50s, there was the McCarthy period, and there was a lot of book constraints then, and there were book constraints about later.
But that was defeated.
Well, there was a period of time libraries wouldn't let you read Lady Chatterley's Lover and all that. There was all that going on, and you know, Orwell wrote his 1984 book at a time when there was a fear of the same thing happening, and it happened during the period of fascism in Europe, and so it's a specter that hangs out there. It happened in throughout history, Middle Ages and elsewhere. People have always tried to control. People in control have tried to control what it is, what might go into people's thoughts. And that was the reason, I think, for the freedom of speech as being such a fundamental founding father issue. And so I think we ought to be very careful about what we do about it. But that isn't to say that we shouldn't worry about what children see and what they do. I just think we ought to give parents the tools to deal with it, and the government dealing with it is a problem. But I'd be interested in how our various listeners think about it, conservative and liberal, because I think this crosses lines between conservative and liberal, and that's why I think ultimately we're converging in the direction of what people of countries like China are doing about the internet.
Well, you know, so you TikTok is something that they've pointed out. This is probably, if you would listen to what some of the people are saying, it's the worst of all of it, and TikTok is the root of all evil, and so we've got to do away with TikTok because the Chinese are engaged in it, and they're going to be spying on us, and so TikTok we've got to do away with. I mean, you talk about the fact that on Elon Musk, what is this?
Twitter.
And we just had that debate. That's still hanging out there. But TikTok right now seems to be, you know, at the root of it. And let's do this. Let's hey Calvin, you're a young guy. I think you're a young guy. Sandy, would he qualify as a young guy?
Well, I'm pretty sure that from my vantage point, that's a big universe.
Yeah. So, man, what's your thought, man, about, you know, banning TikTok and these sites from people? You're a young guy. What are your thoughts?
I think the internet should be open. I don't think the government should be stepping in on what should be on the internet. I think that
you think that there are things on the internet that children should be able to.
Well, of course, but I don't think it's the government's responsibility to be limiting internet. I think that, like you were talking about, the parents need to be the ones monitoring this. I wouldn't be opposed to government like regulations on children like limits on children, but I don't think banning anything for adults would make any amount of sense.
Well, I mean, how about TikTok though? I mean, TikTok is a medium. TikTok, it, you know, can be anything anyone wants it to be when they watch it. It is a source of lots of interesting, useful information, but you can go down some ugly rabbit holes in it too. And it is owned by a Chinese company. Of course, some of the biggest operations are owned by American. Google. Gmail and Google and of course Googling things provides all kinds of information that could be useful. And in fact, it is information that Google provides. You know, what are the Google terms? Well, you know, what was Googled yesterday at 9 o'clock in the morning? And all this stuff could be very useful. But for some reason, a company that's owned by a Chinese company suddenly becomes I think the truth of the concern about it came out in the most recent declarations from Congress, which was the fact that it could be used for propaganda. But propaganda is ideas. Propaganda is speech. Propaganda is thoughts. Propaganda is something that we get lots of, undoubtedly, from the United States. I mean, the fact is that press releases from our government, we all recognize, are not 100% truthful. So I think statements from governments or on behalf of governments that are not 100% truthful, I think that's the definition of propaganda.
You know, Sandy, it's again one of those things. I didn't realize that TikTok had more viewers than any of the others. You know, it just goes to show you, I'm a guy who still thought Facebook was...
Well, TikTok is videos. TikTok is a pretty interesting medium. I look at TikTok because I look at it, I get lots of information about the war in Ukraine, and I get it from Russian sources, I get it from Ukrainian sources, I get it from American sources. It's all stuff that's posted, and you know, if you've got a brain that operates independently, you can look at all this stuff and try and strain through it, figure out what you find. It's got all kinds of other interesting video replays. It's got comedians. You know, it's an interesting medium. But as I said, there are rabbit holes. I'm sure that there's plenty of pornography that you can access through it in terms of videoed stuff. And I don't know what else. But the same can be said about any of these media, you know, in terms of the thoughts that can be conveyed. Twitter has been used from a social media standpoint for plenty of movements that we would decry as being negative influences in our society.
So you would say to pick one out is certainly doesn't make any sense.
Well, it's also a medium that could be repeated. The fact is that they did it very effectively, and so it tends to have a... But Instagram is a great deal like it and could be exactly like it if it decided to fill a void that would be left by getting rid of TikTok.
Well, you know, to be honest with you, Sandy, I almost can't believe that I'm looking at some things sometimes on Instagram or TikTok. I still, for the life of me, I'm kind of blown away that I'm spending some time sometimes, but because it's just like you said. Sometimes there's some things on there that really you can't find anywhere else, right?
Yeah.
And things that are good and beneficial.
Well, and it becomes it's like self-publishing. It's self-publishing for videos. YouTube has the same capacity, and YouTube as well could fill a void of TikTok if it decided to have a 2-minute limit and allowed the same kind of search process and the same kind of search engine response. So, you know, I just think the whole TikTok thing is part of our chinophobia. And I think we have to be worried about it. I think we need to be concerned about it because, like I said, this is all part of our process of backing ourselves into a very big and sharp cactus bush.
You know, after all these things are said and done, do you think they're going to wind up banning it?
I do. I think, so. Once again, it's bipartisan, and whenever something is bipartisan these days in Washington, beware. And I think it right now is a way for Washington politicians to manifest their anti-China view of the world. And being anti-China now is a very bipartisan way to go because it's machismo. It's all part of being a patriot.
844-967-2789 is the number. It's Friday. That means Fridays with Sandy Williams. We'll be right back. Show, as always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday. That means Friday's with my co-host Sandy Williams, and we're talking about whether or not there should be bans on not only TikTok, but, you know, where we are as a society right now with, you know, the banning of books and all of these different things. And clearly, I know Sandy is a guy who is opposed to those kinds of things, and we wanted to know what your thoughts were. Let's go to Tom from L.A. Hey, Tom, what do you say?
Good morning, Earl. First off, we the people.
First off, what's the money? What's the weather like in L.A.? Finally?
Today it's cold. It's cold again. No, it's 50. It's 50 and breezy. I mean, I think it's cold. But I know it's, you know, cold there right now, too, so. I just know climate catastrophe is happening everywhere, and I really believe that.
And, 50 degrees catastrophe again, in L.A. But anyway, go ahead.
This whole winter's been a catastrophe. Rain, floods, it's been horrible.
Yeah.
It's just like Al Gore said, you know, it's going to be extreme weather patterns where it's going to go from hot one day to cold the next day. That's the way, I guess, we're in for, but apparently, the people in that represent us don't really care about that. They care more about the petrochemical and the money in politics issue in terms of not getting it out than anybody else. As far as TikTok goes, give me a break. You know what? Clean up Facebook. Clean up all these other
yeah, Facebook
sites if you want to do something. But you know what? First off, these are private companies. And again, I don't know if people realize it or not, but it's the private companies that have, they do not have to play by the rules of, they can actually constrain someone's First Amendment speech rights and things like that, whereas the government is where we have free speech.
Right.
And
well,
the
but,
thing is,
yeah, but that's my point, Tom, about
company.
Yeah. That's my point. The government shouldn't put these constraints on. It's up to the companies. It's up to the private side of this and the parents to figure out what to do about it.
Right. So if the company chooses to make changes or whatever, that's up to the company. The government should stay out of it. The government should start its own type of social media if they want to, if that's what they want to do. But you know what? TikTok, I find, is probably the least offensive of any of the different and the least propagandized ones. Because Facebook, honestly, to me, is the most propagandized because Facebook is where it's basically like high school reunion. That's what Facebook is. It's basically everyone talking about their personal lives, showing their kids, all these different things. Twitter is more political. Honestly, I find TikTok more of just enjoying videos, enjoying little positive things that people are doing throughout the day and all that kind of stuff. Instagram is probably a little bit more where, and Snapchat are more where they're hurting the actual people
well,
know, out there. But this is ridiculous.
And
When you have bipartisanship, it means that both parties are bought off by the same donors.
Yeah. Interestingly, what's being talked about in Washington is that they want TikTok to be sold out from under a Chinese corporation, in which case they'll be okay with it. So they aren't really content motivated here. This is all about somehow a theory that Chinese ownership taints it. the ownership is subject, whatever company there is subject to whatever the government that is it is local to might do to it, you know, like in the United States. And so, you know, I'm just troubled by the whole thing. I think that it's nonsense, and I think it's a made up problem.
I'm going to make a prediction. If they go ahead and they ban TikTok, you are going to lose the representatives are going to lose a lot of constituents, and people are going to be very angry about this because there's a lot of positive that goes into TikTok. You know what? We can surveil anybody these days. Google Earth can surveil anybody these days. I mean, give me a break. This is just crazy nonsense, if you ask me. I'm not one of those people that's looking for quote-unquote communists under every, you know, bed that there is. I mean, this is ridiculous. And this is a red scare, as far as I'm concerned. And this is something that we have full control over. And I'm sure that if we had some, maybe the United States government's a little bit upset because they don't have something over in China to be able to spy on people. But from what I can see on TikTok, I don't see where there's any problems with TikTok. I see there's more problems with other social media that's out there. And honestly, whether it's the VCR, whether it's whatever it was, there were always positives and negatives to, you know, media. So, you know, this is just another evolution in terms of what it is that we have. And unfortunately, they're the ones that have made us more. We are all in the same world together, and we're not separated.
Hey, but so Tom, again, I'm saying you can't talk about that without talking about banning books. I mean, it's all of those things together seem to be occurring.
Oh no, it's all of their way to distract from the fact that people are not making enough money to pay their rent, to pay their taxes, to pay their child care, and to pay their student loans and pay for food, anything that they can use to distract from the real thing, which is the middle class and the under the middle class, in terms that we need to have a class war in this country. I'm telling you, because they have won so far, and we the people need to stop with all of these little sideshows and all of this stuff and get money out of politics and to develop where we actually go after the rich. I mean, it's just, I'm sorry, I'm all in for the class war, if that's what you want to call it, because there is a class war, and that's the bottom line.
All right, Tom, thank you very much for the call. Sandy?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There's a Russian Facebook, or Russian-owned Facebook version called VKontakt. It's available in the United States. It's not. We're not talking about banning it. It probably only because it isn't terribly successful here. Facebook is. VKontakt isn't. But I just agree with Tam. I think that, and I do agree that TikTok itself is quite an entertaining and can be an entirely innocent site to go to, and that many people will be very upset if it's banned. And I think that the Congress is having fun with their bipartisan anti-Chinese views, but if they decide to act on it in a manner that throttles TikTok in a way that people perceive, I think they're not going to be happy with the outcome.
All right, got to go to a break. We'll be right back. 844-967-2789. It's Fridays with Sandy Williams. We'll be right back.